Top of that, when we got back to Scarborough, he missed our exit. And as much as he tried to hide it, he was lost. On one of the nights on this visit, I went down to the Second City main stage in downtown Toronto. Many of my friends had by now been promoted to the main stage, including Dana Anderson, who was a gifted comedian from Edmonton. He invited me to do the improv set. Because I was now improvising twice a week with the Comedy Store Players in London, my improv skills were sharp. The show's director, Jeff Michalski, was in the audience. I must have had a good show, because the next day, Jeff Michalski invited me to join the Second City mainstage cast full-time. This was, at once, my dream come true and a nightmare. I had promised Neil Malarkey I would go with him one more time to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And besides, things were heating up for Malarkey and Myers in London, and Neil was my comedy partner. It was a marriage. Not only did I respect Neil Malarkey as a brilliant comedian, but I had come to love him as a brother. Neil is one of the good guys in a business often filled with not-so-good guys. I didn't want to leave Neil. I loved the work we were doing. I loved the London comedy circuit, and he and I had built something very special together. But my dad was sick. If I went back to London, I knew that the next time I would see my dad would likely be in half a year, and in that time, I might be returning to see a man who is half of what he once was. Fuck Alzheimer's. Ultimately, this made me decide to accept the invitation to join the main stage cast of Toronto Second City. But I told the producers I had to leave for 3 weeks in the summer to honor my commitment to Malarkey and to go to Edinburgh. In an act of generosity that I will forever be grateful for, they agreed to let me leave for 3 weeks in August. Thank you, Andrew Alexander. Thank you for hiring me the first time, the second time, the third time, and for letting me honor my commitment to Neil Malarkey. You're a class act, Mr. Alexander. I went back to London to tell Neil that I had to return to Canada for my father. He took it well. He was disappointed, as was I, but he was very happy to know that we would at least have Edinburgh. I did two shows at the Toronto Second City main stage. One was called Not Based on Anything by Stephen King. For it, I was nominated for a Dora Maver Moore Award, which is Toronto's Tony Award, and the show won a Dora for Best Musical Review. Our director was John Hempel. He had been in the cast when I was in the touring company, and I consider him to be one of the best improvisers to have ever stood on the Second City main stage. He was also a brilliant director who pushed me and the cast to be the best that we could be. He was hilarious, disciplined, and highly principled. I will always cherish the time we had together, shoulder to shoulder, trying to put together the best possible show, and then afterwards, shoulder to shoulder, drinking many Molson Canadians. Many was the night that John and I, after drinking in legitimate bars, would go to speakeasies until even they closed, ultimately ending up at the Golden Griddle Pancake House on Jarvis Street, eating silver dollar pancakes and drinking overly strong coffee, talking about comedy movies that we loved, as the blue of dawn warmed up the summer day. Fantastic memories. Not a care in the world, except that the show would be great. Thank you, John Hempel. I would walk home on those blue mornings in Toronto. Never once did I worry about crime. I had the presence of mind to realize what a great thing it is to live in a safe country. Other countries talk about freedom, but the freedom to walk home at night, knowing that the chances of being attacked are slim to none, is perhaps one of the greatest freedoms. There is also great freedom in living in a culture that isn't particularly angry. But a lack of danger does have its downside. Inversely, necessity or scarcity can often be the mother of invention or industry, respectively. Before I left for England, I had a sense that Canada had drifted away from its mission of urgently forging an identity. When I returned from England, an even deeper malaise had set in. Canada didn't seem as Canadian. So, in response to that, my work became more Canadian. I did Wayne Campbell in this Second City show. He was unabashedly from Scarborough, and I felt that Toronto audiences knew it was authentic to my home borough. John Hempel had written a song for the show called Fade Away. It was set to the tune of Sail Away by Randy Newman, and it ended the show. The message of Fade Away was that Canada was losing its culture, that our culture was being subsumed by American consumerism. It listed all the things that Canadians no longer paid attention to because of the magnetic power of American consumer culture. An American friend came up to see the show and was shocked at how anti-American the song was. I said, "Didn't you think that we Canadians might have an opinion on you Americans?" "Not really," he said. "Well, what do Americans think of Canada?" I asked. "We don't." Game, set, and match. Producers from the CBC saw me at Second City and invited me to do sketch pieces on their show, It's Only Rock and Roll, a rock-themed variety show, sort of a talk show, sort of a news show. I did two characters on It's Only Rock and Roll. Once again, Wayne Campbell, which I did as Wayne's Power Minute, out of a panel van we called the Shaggin' Wagon, and a German experimental artist named Dieter. The producers were pleased, and I was asked to do more and more Wayne's Power Minute segments, leading up to hosting the It's Only Rock and Roll Christmas special. My dad's condition, however, was continuing to deteriorate. There was a brief period when my dad was aware that he had this disease, and in the spirit of how fast can we find this funny, he insisted on calling Alzheimer's old-timer's disease. It was the best of times, and it was the worst of times. His condition worsened to the point where he no longer recognized me. The Rubicon had been crossed. I needed to get out of town. I'd never been to Chicago before, but I had a vacation coming, so I went to Chicago to see the Toronto Maple Leafs play the Blackhawks at the old Chicago Stadium, one of the original six. I wanted to get to the stadium before it was torn down. Chicago and Toronto have a lot in common. Toronto is an Iroquois word meaning meeting place. Chicago comes from the Algonquin meaning wild garlic or wild onion. The cities are roughly the same size. Both are on a great lake. Both have a proud tradition of comedy, and by way of our Chicago brothers, improv comedy. But that may be where the similarities end. In Toronto, the subway would take you to College Station, half a block away from Maple Leaf Gardens, right next to Toronto's fantastic gay neighborhood on Church Street. On the other hand, the Blackhawks play in a bad neighborhood, on the other side of the infamous Cabrini Green Homes, the housing projects made famous in the 1970s sitcom Good Times. I got in a cab and told the driver I was going to Chicago Stadium. He asked me, in his thick Chicago accent, "Oh my God, are you sure? That's a pretty scary place." This did not bode well. We made our way west, and as we got closer to Cabrini Green, the cab driver auto-locked the doors, rolled up the windows, and reclined his seat back so far that he was lying down while driving. He sped up to 60 miles per hour and went through a red light. Being Canadian, I didn't want to criticize him, but when he went through a second red light, I spoke up. "What are you doing?" I asked. "Snipers," he said. "What? Snipers? What do you mean?" "See these buildings? They love to snipe cabs. Don't worry about the red lights in this neighborhood. They're just street decoration. If I were you, buddy, I'd get your head down." I lay flat on the back seat, and within 5 minutes, I was at the front doors of Chicago Stadium. The building looked exactly like a doppelganger of Maple Leaf Gardens. The atmosphere was electric. All the fans wore Blackhawk sweaters. I had been warned not to wear my Leaf sweater, but I had to wear it. I was also told not to celebrate if the Leafs scored. Although it almost killed me, caution ruled the day, and I sat on my hands as Wendell Clark potted a wrister from the left side, top shelf, where Mama keeps the peanut butter. To my surprise, Blackhawks fans were polite, welcoming, and downright friendly. We Leafs fans pride ourselves on our hockey smarts, but these Blackhawks fans had the knowledge, despite only getting half a page of hockey news in the Tribune, as opposed to 4 pages in the Toronto Star. In fact, Toronto has 8 pages of hockey news on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Heaven. Seeing how hard it was to get to Chicago Stadium, I came away feeling that these Hawks fans were true hockey fans. Much respect. The only grief I got was from a 300-pound Blackhawks superfan who wore every possible piece of Blackhawks merchandise. He was a known regular, shouting out a play-by-play of events on and off the ice in a deep, raspy frog voice with a very thick Chicago accent. As I walked up the aisle, he saw my Leaf sweater and bellowed, "Leafs suck!" When a pretty girl went by, he shouted out in his frog voice, "Hockey bitch! Hockey bitch!" It was more ridiculous than offensive. The entire section broke into uproarious laughter, including the pretty girl. It was a far cry from Maple Leaf Gardens, where you could often hear a pin drop. There was an energy in Chicago that at the time was lacking in Toronto. I wanted to sample this energy. I wanted to be in the home of the original Second City, where Elaine May, Mike Nichols, John Belushi, and Bill Murray created one of the most dynamic movements of sketch comedy in the history of mankind. It was also the home of Mr. Del Close. Del Close was one of the founding members of Second City back in the 1950s, along with Nichols, May, and Paul Sills. He was older, an ex-junkie, his body covered in track marks, which he called his tracksuit. He was a Wicca witch who often asked his students to invoke demons as part of their improv training. Del was one of the Merry Pranksters, a group of experimental artists and hippies who lived in a bus and were based out of San Francisco. Tom Wolfe wrote about the Merry Pranksters in his book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. Del was one of the inventors of The Happening, which was an unscripted, quote-unquote, event that ravers would well recognize. He and his partner, Sharna Halpern, ran a Chicago theater called the Improv Olympics. Del didn't just teach improv. He taught creativity. He would have salons at his house where the nature of creativity was discussed and creative happenings spontaneously manifested. One day, I brought over a deck of hockey cards, and with these cards I read Del's fortune, which I called Canadian Tarot. Improvising my best spiritual voice, I said, "As there are four divisions in the NHL, there are four energy quadrants that predict your future. I want you to pull out a card. This will be your defenseman card." He pulled out Ray Bourque. I said, "Ah, the Ray Bourque card. And I see you've placed it in the Norris Division quadrant. There are many fights in the Norris Division. We call it the Chuck Norris Division. Just as Ray Bourque is a stay-at-home defenseman, you will find yourself doing projects around the house, but be careful. His slap shot is hard. Someone you know will turn on you. Don't be a hero. Don't try and block the shot." He was a heavy smoker, and my reading of him caused him to laugh to the point of a coughing fit. Gaining his respect was one of the highlights of my creative life. For Del, every art form and all parts of living were to be studied and incorporated into improv. One day, Del was giving a workshop. He was talking about how important it is that the performer not believe that they were better than their audience. He felt the audience was always smarter than the person on stage. He told a story of going to the Canadian National Exhibition and finding himself in one of the trade show buildings. He was looking at the mass of people going from booth to booth, like so much human cattle. He had caught himself feeling superior. But then he passed an Encyclopedia Britannica booth where a Liverpudlian man was selling encyclopedias. He said that this Englishman was so funny that it reminded him that a sense of humor is not exclusive to professionals. I raised my hand. He said, "How can I help you?" I said, "Yeah, that Liverpudlian selling encyclopedias?"
"Yes."
"He's my father." The rest of the class gave a collective gasp. "I'm serious. This actually happened. Spooky." But things like this were everyday occurrences in Del's class. There was an element of magic. Ideas flew around the room. Connections were made. Synchronicity was rife. Del's classes had an almost hive mind quality. And it was intoxicating. And it wasn't Toronto, where my dad was. Or wasn't. So I applied for a transfer from Toronto Second City to Chicago Second City. The owner of Second City Toronto Andrew Alexander, and his Chicago counterpart, Bernie Sollins, were kind enough to grant that request. My entry into Chicago's Second City main stage was not an easy one. There was much resistance. One Chicago cast member took me to lunch to, quote-unquote, be my friend, by informing me that I was not welcome in Chicago, that the cast, whom I had only briefly met, resented my foreign intrusion, and that my Toronto Second City style of improv and comedy, which emphasized character and observation, didn't jive with the superior political satire tradition of the, quote-unquote, senior Chicago mainstage. I wasn't used to this type of psych-out aggressive behavior. Comedy in Canada and Britain is not a macho affair. Canadian comedy is much more self-deprecating. I had heard stories of Bill Murray diving into the crowd of Second City in Chicago and having fistfights with hecklers. We didn't do that in Toronto. On my third week at Second City Chicago, it was a particularly cold day and we were rehearsing in the empty, freezing theater. I had only one sweater, which my beloved Auntie Molly had knitted for me. I wore it so much that it had a hole in it. At one point in the rehearsal, one huge Chicago castmate interrupted me and said, "Nice sweater. Why don't we all pitch in and get Myers a new sweater?" I said, "Why don't we all pitch in and get this fucking asshole some manners?" There was an uneasy, hushed "ooh" from the rest of the cast. I don't know where my quick response came from. Probably Scarborough. In Scarborough, you have to be fast, you have to be funny, or you have to be ready to fight. I was transported back to the Toronto subway platform at Kennedy Station, the end of the line. Later that night, I was on stage improvising a scene about world affairs. I played a stuffy British diplomat who made three, I thought, reasonable and not terribly controversial statements. In my Brit character, I said, "The Kennedys were rum runners to Canada. Canada won the War of 1812, and the Americans dropped the atomic bomb on the Japanese, not to bring Hirohito to heel, but to scare the crap out of the Russians as an opening salvo of the Cold War." Some members of the audience took mock offense at these remarks, but overall my British character was well received, getting some nice laughs. When I got backstage, that same huge Chicago cast member pinned me against the wall screaming, "How dare you come to this country, take an American jab, and take a shit on America!" I was shocked. Wasn't Second City a bastion of democratic politics? Wasn't this the theater that the rioters from the 1968 Democratic National Convention ran to as sanctuary from Mayor Daley's quote-unquote pigs? This dude was huge, and I was cornered. I realized that I was in a physical fight, and once again, Scarborough came to the rescue. In my thickest Canadian accent, I said to him, "Hey, buddy, get your fucking hands off me, or there's going to be two sounds, my Canadian fist breaking your ugly American jaw and your Yankee head hitting the fucking floor." "Oh, yeah, jag bag?" I said, "Jag bag? What the fuck is a jag bag? You Chicago pricks can't even swear right. I'm Canadian, asshole. I've been in 1,000 hockey fights. I don't give a fuck how big you are. I'm going to fuck you up hockey style." For the record, I'd never been in a hockey fight. But it worked. He let me go. He would have killed me. In my head, I thought, did I almost get in a brawl? We're doing comedy, people. I hate fighting. But my Liverpool dad had always said, you only fight to get out of a fight. And he was right. It was a Scarborough bluff. Despite a couple of dust-ups, I do love Chicago, and the people I worked with were very talented, very passionate, and very dedicated artists. The late Bernie Sollins and the late Joyce Sloan were lovers of the arts and generous believers in me. I'm honored to have had the privilege of walking that storied stage. Dal Close was a creative genius, and amongst his talents was the gift of exploring and heightening the talents of others. He was a true revolutionary in the actors' liberation movement, which is what Dell liked to call improvisation. Above all, he was brave enough to insist on truth, even at the expense of a joke, and even at his own expense. He was a kingmaker, having honed the likes of Belushi and Farley, but he was so committed to the truth that he once bravely said of himself, "I am the door through which others pass, and I cannot." While he enjoyed comedy that came from a place of, "Wouldn't it be funny if?" he treasured comedy of truth. Comedy that started from, "Isn't it funny that?" I owe much to Chicago, but I wasn't meant to stay there long. Meanwhile, at that time, Toronto Second City was celebrating its 15th anniversary, and because I had moved to Chicago, I was now technically an alumnus, thus eligible to participate in Toronto's star-studded 15th anniversary alumni show. Other alumni included Martin Short, Eugene Levy, Catherine O'Hara, Andrea Martin, Joe Flaherty, and Dave Thomas. In the crowd were many celebrities like Michael Keaton, as well as producers and casting directors. It was a big deal. I flew back to Toronto and had the novel experience of staying in a hotel in my home city. When I got to the theater, it was packed with television crews and fans waiting outside to see who was arriving. I, of course, took the subway there and entered through the back door because I was not somebody anyone wanted to see. I went backstage, looked at the running order, and saw that I was in 4 sketches. Very few sketches compared to the star cast members. I was having feelings of not belonging. I got why the big stars were there, but I was unknown. During the first act, I did 2 of my 4 sketches. The first played to polite applause. The second was plagued with so much audience chatter that Michael Keaton generously began a shushing campaign. At the intermission, I went downstairs. I was despondent. Dave Foley from the Kids in the Hall caught me downtrodden. He said, "What's going on? You're killing out there." I said, "I feel like such an asshole. I shouldn't have come. The audience just wants to see the stars, and I don't blame them. I'm thinking of going home." Then Foley said, "What do you have in the second act?" I said, "I start the second act with Wayne Campbell." He goes, "They're letting you do Wayne? You're going to kill, asshole. It's going to be great." It was the bucking up that I needed. Foley has always been my champion. I changed into my Wayne costume and took my starting position, which happened to be in the crowd, breaking the fourth wall. The lights came up. Drunken stragglers took their seats, and I began performing from the crowd. At first, people thought I was an underage heckler. Then people started to get it. Then I got my first laugh. Then I took the stage. And then it started to grow. B laughs, then A laughs, then laughs where we had to hold, waiting for the audience to finish. Then everything played. And when the lights went out, there was thunderous applause, cheers, stomps, whistles. It was like a jet taking off. It had fucking killed. I was stunned. As I took my place in the line, I heard a voice from below. It was Michael Keaton. "Hey, kid." He ran up 2 flights of stairs. "That Wayne sketch is awesome. Congratulations." I couldn't believe his generosity. My fellow line mates were just as blown away. "That was Michael Keaton, you know." "Oh, I know," I said. At the after party, there was a main table where all the big names, including the SCTV cast, sat and schmoozed. I took a table in the corner, as far away from the main table as possible. The SCTV cast were and are my heroes, and I didn't want to crowd them like others were doing. They came over and sat at my table. I couldn't believe it. They were so incredibly generous and nice. It was a magical evening. The next day, I returned to Chicago and got a phone call. It was Lorne Michaels. He offered me a job as a featured performer and writer on Saturday Night Live. Martin Short had recommended me to Lorne based on my performance at Toronto Second City's 15th anniversary show the night before. Another Canadian, Pam Thomas, producer on The Kids in the Hall and wife of Dave Thomas, who had also been there that night, also called Lorne on my behalf. Yet another Canadian, my dear friend Dave Foley, had called Lorne Michaels. I felt like I was being taken care of by the Canadian mob. I thank them all. Many things coalesced on that day. I remembered that I had promised myself I would never go to New York unless I was offered a job. I flashed on the first time I saw Saturday Night Live with Gilda Radner, when I, sucky baby, had precociously declared that I would someday be on that show. And I was also reminded that the person who most wanted to see me on Saturday Night Live, my dad, would never know. When I got to New York City, it was a whole new world. Although Toronto was only 500 miles away, it might as well have been in Alpha Centauri. As a fellow Canadian, Lorne Michaels knew my particular challenges. He said I had a good chance of doing well at SNL because I would have the Canadian humility that says I'd better work hard and study. But he also cautioned that, as a Canadian, I would have a hard time accepting that talent and character don't always go hand in hand. He said that, as a Canadian, I would be devastated when one of my heroes turned out to be a prick. And, of course, he was right. Over time, I came to accept the talent-character discrepancy, but it's true. Canadians will ask, "Have you met so-and-so?" And if I say yes, their follow-up question is, "Was so-and-so nice?" Americans will ask, "Have you met so-and-so?" But their follow-up question is, "What's so-and-so like?" Canadians need to know they were nice. Americans just want the inside scoop. If they're nice, fine. If not, oh well. In many ways, because I was a fellow Canadian, Lorne took me under his wing. Lorne is very erudite, with a wide knowledge of history and art and an appreciation of European films. I, too, loved European films, and because Toronto was such a movie town, I was familiar with many of the films he spoke about. I shared with Lorne my love of the French film director Louis Malle. To my delight, Lorne told me that not only was he friends with Louis Malle, but that in a few weeks Malle would be coming to New York because his wife, Candice Bergen, was hosting SNL. Lorne invited me to dinner with Malle. It was to be my dinner with Louis. For the entire meal, I sat silent, intimidated by my boss and in awe of Monsieur Malle. Lorne told Louis that I had written a high school essay about his movie La Combe Lucienne. The essay was called Lucien Lacombe, Evil Villain or a Product of His Time. Lorne, in an act of incredible generosity, said, "Mike, I believe you have a question for Louis." I said through a croaking voice, "Monsieur Malle, I wrote an essay about Lacombe Lucien in which I wondered if the main character Lucien Lacombe was evil or just the product of his time." He said to me, "What conclusion did you draw?" I said, "I thought he was a product of his time." Louis Malle said, "Oh no, he was just evil." When does that ever happen in life? I felt like Woody Allen in Annie Hall being able to pull Marshall McLuhan from around the corner. People always say that you never use the knowledge you learned in high school. I beg to differ. Thank you, Canadian education system, and thank you, Lorne. Lorne and I bonded over Canada. He was amused by my constant Canadian obsession with fairness. This wasn't fair, that wasn't fair. One day, somebody had done something to me that was absolutely, without question, so completely unfair. I was really upset, and honestly, rightly so. In Scarborough, nobody likes a snitch, but this was so bad that I had to go and tell the boss. I waited an hour outside of Lauren's office, getting angrier and angrier at how unfair this person had been to me. By the time I got into his office, I was steaming. I said, "Fuck me, Lorne. Blank blank did blank blank. That's so unfair." Lorne said, "Yeah, you're right. But Mike, you don't want the world to be fair." I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Had so many years in New York erased every molecule of Lorne's Canadianness? I said, "What? Of course we want the world to be fair." Lorne said, "No, Mike, you don't want the world to be fair. For example, it's not fair that you're more talented than most people." I was dumbstruck. What a brilliant way to get someone to get off the whole fair thing. Flattery. Genius! I don't know if Lorne actually believed the things he said about me, but I can tell you it stopped me cold. I could have slept for 10 hours. I back-pocketed the "you don't want the world to be fair" move, and I've used it successfully with my children. Lorne reminded me that I wasn't in Canada anymore. Here in America, people play for all the marbles. Americans pitied their athletes who only got a silver, feeling bad that the silver medalist had, quote-unquote, lost. He said that the civility I had grown up with in Canadian show business was due to the fact that there was no money in it. It's very easy to be civil when the stakes are low. In America, the rewards were great, but so was the competition, and so was the pressure. Working on Saturday Night Live is so all-pervasive that it's like working on a submarine under the polar ice cap. You write Monday and Tuesday, read the material Wednesday, rehearse Thursday and Friday. Then, during the day on Saturday, you do a dress rehearsal that isn't shown to the public, and then do the actual show that airs live at 11:30 p.m., ending at 1 a.m. There's an obligatory party in Manhattan, and you get Sunday to nurse the hangover, and then it starts over again. The contract is for 6 years. Dana Carvey described being on the show as once a week being shot out of a cannon with no net to catch you. Gilda Radner described Saturday Night Live as an under-rehearsed Broadway opening once a week. She also said that it's an insatiable monster that eats your material insatiably. Lauren described the show as the court of the Borgias, and even the nicest Borgia still has a poison ring. On one occasion, a crew member gave me a cappuccino. Lauren took it out of my hands and said, "Do you know him?" I said, "No." He said, "Never take a drink from someone you don't know." And he threw the coffee in the garbage. And then on my fourth show, I saw what he meant. I'd been hired halfway through the season. I wasn't a full cast member, so I had to write for myself. I'd had some small pieces and sketches, but nothing I'd written had gotten into the show. As I mentioned before, Wednesday is read-through day. At read-through, the cast sits around the table with the host, Lorne, senior producers, and the director. Chairs are brought in and arranged around the read-through table, forming a gallery. The writers all sat together on the right, production staff on the left, and the technical artisans in the center. To call the read-through a tough room is like saying Ebola is a bad cold. The writers don't want you to succeed, the producers are afraid that the show is going to be too complicated to produce this week, and if you're a new guy, like I was, the technical staff don't know who you are and aren't sure if you're going to be around next week. As for Lauren, the man has literally heard or written himself every possible joke combination known to man. It was Tuesday night. I had decided it was time to do my Wayne Campbell character on SNL. If it flamed out, I lost my big gun. I had struggled with how to introduce the character for the three previous shows, but I had hit on an idea of placing Wayne in a cable access show as cable access was hitting its stride. I would make it the most local show in the history of television. It would literally be about Wayne's basement and, if he was feeling adventurous, upstairs. I struggled with having Wayne be a Canadian. I'd been in the States long enough to know that there was a universal suburban heavy metal kid experience, the same long hair with baseball cap, worky boots, ripped jeans, black concert t-shirts, and the belief that Zepp was God. And all heavy metal guys wanted to do was look for chicks. And besides, within a week, I realized that none of my American co-workers, writers or actors, knew anything about Canada. Most thought that Montreal was the capital city, not Ottawa. The majority didn't realize that we had our own currency. They all thought that Canada only had winter. Some were confused that I was claiming to be Canadian, and yet I was only 5'7", as if it was the land of giants. So I started to play games. I insisted that Canadian Tire money was our actual currency, a claim that went unchallenged. I told them that not only was there a Canadian Thanksgiving, but there was a Canadian Christmas in July, when Jesus actually died. That July, one sensitive American colleague sent me a Christmas card. I became a one-man public relations firm for Canada. I began to pretend that I wasn't familiar with universally known American customs. For example, I feigned ignorance of Independence Day, sarcastically asking if it was America's equivalent of Canada Day. I pretended to not know the name of the World Series, coyly calling it the Stanley Cup of baseball. Not only was I out of the country, I was starting to go out of my mind. In retaliation, Kevin Nealon developed a quote-unquote Mike Myers impression that started every sentence with, "In Canada?" with the same sing-song of the girl in American Pie who started every sentence with, "This one time? At band camp?" I decided that Wayne would be from Aurora, Illinois, just outside of Chicago, because there's a town called Aurora, Ontario, just north of Toronto. Aurora, Ontario, is very similar to Scarborough. I made no concession to a Chicago accent. I wrote Wayne's first SNL sketch on a yellow legal pad, handwritten and stapled. I called the sketch Wayne's World. At 5 o'clock on Wednesday morning, I put the sketch on the hand-in pile outside the head writer's office. It was an intimidating pile, usually consisting of 40 or so sketches. The cast and writers I had been hired into were of the highest quality. I thought they were going to be good. I didn't know they were going to be that good. I took a seat on one of the couches and started to drift off when one of the senior writers came into the read-through room, went over to the pile, and picked up my sketch. In my head, I was screaming, "You can't look at the pile," but he was doing it. As he read my sketch, not only was he not laughing, but he was shaking his head in disgust. He caught me watching him. He said to me, "Did you write this?" Holding back both tears and vomit, I said, "Yes." And with that, he took my sketch off the pile and put it on the read-through table. My mind started racing. What does that mean? Does it mean he just decided I wasn't allowed to hand it in? I didn't even know you were allowed to look at the pile. Wait a minute. He just took my sketch off the pile and put it on the read-through table. Then he left the room. I froze. A second later, another senior writer came in and picked up my sketch off the table and began to read it. His reaction was a little more animated. As he read, he said things like, "No," and, "Oh my God, this sucks." And then, "Seriously?" He turned to me and said, "Don't hand this in. It sucks. You'll never win over the read-through table. Honestly, this sucks." Then he took my sketch and threw it on the ground. He took my sketch and threw it on the ground. It was 5 o'clock in the morning. I was jet-lagged. I was vomitous. I wasn't even angry. I was freaked out. I'd finally made it to Saturday Night Live. I had a character that people seemed to like in Canada. I thought I finally found a way to get it on the show. I'd worked my ass off, combing through it over and over again. I'd gotten up the courage to put it on the dreaded pile, and now my career was over. I sat down for 20 minutes, staring into space, wondering what I was going to tell my friends in Toronto. I was trying to come up with what I call my, quote, dignity answer. The story I would tell them about why I'd been fired, while somehow making it seem it wasn't my fault and that it was the best thing that had ever happened to me. And then something happened. As if a hand had pulled me up by the scruff of my neck, I got up, went over to the sketch, restapled it, and put it back on the pile. I thought, fuck it. I'm not going to let these assholes psych me out. If it dies at the read-through table, fair enough, but I'm going down swinging. A calmness came over me, and I walked home through the empty, freezing canyons of Midtown to my 400-square-foot apartment and slept. When I woke up at 1 p.m., I zipped in a cab to 30 Rock to see if my sketch had indeed been typed up and put into the read-through pack. It had, but it was sketch number 40 of 40 sketches. In order to soothe the host, the producers would front-load the read-through with sketches they thought were likely to get in. Best came first, worst came last. At around sketch number 20 in the running order, everyone starts to get antsy. They know that the crappy sketches are coming, everyone is sleep-deprived, and everyone starts to get hungry. Lauren starts to eat his carrots around now, which is tough because he reads the stage directions. So now, if your sketch is in the second half of the pack, the stage directions are read with a full mouth. Lauren himself would sometimes start to make comments about the quality of the second half sketches, saying things like, "Honest to fuck, can't we screen some of this bullshit?" My sketch was last. The crowd's patience was running out. Finally, it came to my sketch. Lauren turned to everyone and said, "How are we all feeling? Should we do this?" Dana shot a look over to me and gave me an encouraging thumbs up. I piped up, "I think we should." which, thankfully, got a smattering of chuckles. The sketch began. Lorne, now through a mouthful of popcorn, began the stage directions. I launched into the Wayne's World theme with every ounce of enthusiasm I could muster. Through sheer will, the song, Wayne's World, Party Time, Excellent, woo, got a fairly significant laugh. Lauren's eyebrow raised. And then our first joke got a good laugh. Then the next. Then we got a big woof. Then I did the theme again, and people were doing it along with me. Then another joke killed. Then it was over, and it got a round of applause, which is a very rare thing at any time during the read-through, even more rare when it's the last of 40 sketches. Dana shot me another thumbs up. I mouthed, "Thank you," to him, because he didn't need to sell it as much as he did, but he sold the shit out of it. Which, because Dana was held in such high esteem, was the read-through equivalent of the Good Housekeeping seal of approval. People left the read-through on a high. The technical staff gave me a pat on the back. The writers scattered. Phil Hartman put his arm around me and said, "I don't know if it's going to get in, but I think you may have won the table." And then the wait began. After read-through, there's a 3-hour wait as you sit outside Lauren's office, where you hope one of Lauren's assistants will come out of Lauren's office and call your name to have you come into the room. Lauren's assistants came in and out 10 times. My name was not called. The show only ever mounted 11 to 12 sketches every week, so it wasn't looking good. I gathered my coat and made my way to the elevator bank, comforted by the fact that maybe Phil was right, that if it wasn't this week, it might be next week, but I certainly wasn't dead. I had just hit the elevator button when a frantic and angry assistant came up to me. "Are you Mike Myers?" "Yes," I said. "Where the fuck are you going?" she demanded. "Home," I said. "Lauren wants you in there right now." "Am I being fired?" I asked. "No, asshole, your sketch, Wally's World, is in. Better hustle. And next time, don't fucking make me look for you." I ran to Lauren's office. The Canadian comedian Leslie Nielsen was the host. Lauren sat at his desk, the Empire State Building behind his head. The producers sat in their chairs against the wall. From the look of it, Wayne's World was not their first choice. Lauren said to me, "You got called 10 minutes ago, stay close. Here's the deal, it's in, but it's last. If the show runs over, it'll get cut. Is there a way to work Leslie into it?" For some stupid reason, I said, "No." Lauren said, "Yes is a better answer." "Oh, okay. Do you know what to do?" "No," I said. Lauren said, "Go ask a grown-up, and don't ever make me wait again." I walked out of the office. I say, quote, I walked out of the office, but I don't remember actually moving my legs. I wanted to cry from relief, but I always remember what my dad said whenever I scored a goal. He would say, "After it goes in, casually walk back to your position, as if it's no big deal, and it happens all the time." Although my dad was still alive, his Alzheimer's had taken away much of his personality. I had never missed my dad more than at that moment, and I couldn't help but feel that it was his hand that lifted me up by the scruff and made me put the sketch back on the pile. Conan O'Brien came to my aid. He saw my stunned look and said to me, "Hey, that Wayne's World thing is so fucking funny and so fucking weird. The song, it's so stupid. Hey, do you know what to do?" "No," I said. He said, "Follow me." He took me into a room that I didn't know existed because I'd never had a sketch get on before. Just to the left of Lauren's office was a whole other office where the sets were designed, the costumes were put together, and where the floor director, the wonderful, patient, caring, sensitive, but nobody's fool, Kenny Among, had his lair. Kenny would tell you where your sketch was in the running order, what stage your sketch would be on in Studio 8H, what time on Thursday your sketch would be rehearsed, and then he would lead you through the process of rewrites, and most important, how you got your sketch onto the cue cards. Kenny took me under his arm for the whole 6 years I was there. In fact, the entire crew took me under their arms. I love those people. I survived the week of rehearsal. Every week, Lorne mounts roughly 12 sketches and only 10 make it. There are two shows on Saturday night, the first show, called The Dress Show, which is an 8:30 p.m. dress rehearsal, and then The Air Show, which is the main broadcast at 11:30 p.m. During The Dress Show, Wayne's World was on last. Sketches on last have a hard time making it into The Air Show. Audiences are tired by then. Our performance during The Dress Show felt like it went well. And then the waiting began. Would our sketch make it to air? Lorne has another office on the 9th floor that overlooks the 8th floor studio. It is tiny. When you have a sketch that might make the show, you wait in a room next to it. When Lorne has picked The Air Show, an assistant opens the door and you're let in. The door opened, and immediately I look to the running order, which is on the big board at the far end of the room. For each sketch, there's a 3x5 card, and all the 3x5 cards are in the show order. To the left of the big board is where the 3x5 cards of sketches that didn't make it are pinned, willy-nilly. I look to the left. Phew, we were in. I look for my sketch. Once again, Wayne's World was the last sketch of the show, but we were in. Or were we? Lorne went through the notes. The notes are often brutal and remarkably detailed. Things like clocks being the wrong time, maps being out of date, jokes that didn't work, minutes that need to be taken out, etc. When he got to Wayne's World, he had a few notes, one of which was that he didn't want me to push it too much. And then he said, "Be prepared. If we run over, Wayne's World is cut." Then we had to rush to the assistants and give them the cuts and changes. Then you have to rush to the cue cards to give them the cuts and changes. And then you run over the cue cards to make sure that things are spaced right. Then you run to makeup. And then it's showtime. I was blown away and continue to be blown away every time the late Don Pardo said my name. Such history. The show progressed. Sketches that killed it read through and were flat in dress were killing on The Air Show. Sketches that were okay at read through and had killed it dress were a little flat on air. I was astonished at how unpredictable the success of a sketch was. Halfway through the show, Wayne's World had still not been cut. 3/4 of the way through, still not cut. 4/5 of the way through, I got summoned to Lorne's 3rd office, which is under the bleachers. Lorne said, "If this next sketch goes long and the musical act goes long, you're cut." I sat beside him. The sketch ran short, and the musical act was perfectly on time. Lorne turned to me, and in a scene that seemed to be taken from a movie, said, "All right, you're on." I was pumped, and by now, calm, just ready to enjoy it. We went out there. The sketch started. It played okay at first, and then we got our first big laugh. Then another, and a nice round of applause at the end. I went on stage for the good nights. I was emotionally exhausted, but unbelievably proud. I had only one day to recover, and then it would all start again. When Dave Foley heard that I had been hired for SNL, he told me to hang out with Phil Hartman. Foley said that Phil was my type of performer. He did characters, he had fantastic concentration, and he always tried his hardest, even if the material wasn't strong. More important, Foley told me that Phil was from Canada, Brantford, Ontario, to be precise, the home of Wayne Gretzky. Phil had been on the show for 3 years before I got hired, and I had never seen him perform because I was living in England. When I was briefly living in Toronto, I worked Saturday nights at Second City, and I had one of those early Soviet top-loading VCRs that only gave you 3.5 hours of tape. Being a diehard Leafs fan, on Saturday, I had to choose between taping the game or Saturday Night Live. I'll let you guess which program got taped. As a sidebar, because of my VCR situation, I never saw Dana's church lady or John Lovett's liar until I was on the show. I did, however, watch Gary Lehman of the Toronto Maple Leafs score 30 goals that year. Further sidebar, my best friend, Dave McKenzie, played on Gary Lehman's soccer team for a while. But I digress. As luck would have it, I was seated next to Phil at the read-through table, and in my first week, I struck up a conversation with him, launching headlong into Leafs banter. Phil was not a hockey fan. In fact, Phil had moved to America at the age of 10, and while he had great affection for Canada, he had only a cursory knowledge of it. With that first meeting, a running gag was born, wherein I insisted that he was the most Canadian person I'd ever met. And in some ways, it was true. Phil was a true team player. He was studious. He did his homework. On read-through day, he was the first to the table to study his stack of sketches, which was half a foot tall. My stack, for comparison, was an inch tall. Phil would insert the sketches into his official Saturday Night Live binder, which you're given when you join the cast, which nobody except Phil used. Moreover, Phil customized his SNL binder with a three-hold, zippered, see-through binder sleeve that contained colored pencils, erasers, post-its, and mints. Phil Hartman's instrument, his body, and his voice was so versatile and refined that I've never seen anything like it, except perhaps for Peter Sellers or Dan Aykroyd. Before the read-through, Phil went through each sketch and made coded margin notes. Phil had determined that he had 11, quote-unquote, core characters, each of whom was numbered. For example, his Charlton Heston voice was a core character, and it was designated as number 3. If a number 3 was an authority figure, a blue pencil mark was put next to it. If it was an angry number 3 authority figure, a red pencil mark would go next to the blue pencil mark. The intensity of any character was measured on a scale out of 10, and in green pencil, he would designate the correct intensity to the right of the color designates. In summation, if the character kind of talked like Charlton Heston and was an angry authority figure who was mildly intense, Phil would make the following notation. 3, blue pencil, red pencil, 6. He had created for himself the comedy character equivalent of musical notation. You can't get more Canadian than that. We love our standardized units of weights and measurements. Phil could make anything funny, which, of course, was why everyone wrote for him, including me. Phil could save not only a sketch, but an entire show. He held the show together. After any sketch where Phil knocked it out of the park, it became customary for the entire read-through table and audience to go, "Glue." And it was my job to be the sports announcer who went, "They're not saying boo, folks. They're saying glue. Another fine performance from Mr. Phil Hartman of Brantford, Ontario." After a while, Phil didn't write sketches. He didn't have to. I, of course, always had to write sketches. Tuesday night was writing night, and my office was next to Phil's. While I spent the entire evening pulling out my hair, trying to come up with an idea, Phil was relaxed and sat at his desk doing various hobbies. One day I passed his office and he said, "Kid, come in. Do you have any interest in diamonds?" He had a jeweler's loupe on his eye and he was looking at some diamonds he had just bought. "Mike, when buying diamonds, you have to examine each stone for the 4 C's, cut, carat, color, and clarity." I assured Phil that I wasn't going to be buying diamonds anytime soon. In fact, if I didn't come up with a sketch that night, the only thing I'd be buying would be a one-way ticket back to Toronto. On another Tuesday writing night, Phil was once again in his office, this time looking at helicopter shots of vacation property in the British Virgin Islands. "Mike, Come on in, kid, he said. The three most important things in real estate are location, location, and location.
Thanks, Phil, I said.
My favorite Tuesday night was one time when I popped into his office to say hello, only to be told, shh, don't move. Phil was sweating, and he was staring intently at something on his desk through a high-powered magnifying glass attached to a flexi arm. I approached gingerly. Phil was using special long tweezers and special long scissors. And then it occurred to me. Phil was putting a ship in a bottle. I had walked in on him at the critical moment where one pulls the string that lifts the mainsail. With the steady hand of a surgeon, Phil calmly used the tweezers to tie off the mainsail string, and then he snipped off the remainder of the string using the special long scissors. I was a nervous wreck, so hopped up on coffee that I could barely hold a pencil, and here was Phil putting a ship into a bottle. I said, a ship in a bottle?
Mikey, you need to get a hobby, he said.
Unfortunately, the last time I passed his office on a writing night was the most disturbing. Phil had several high-quality, glossy brochures displaying firearms. He was planning to buy a gun.
Mikey, come on in, he said. Have you ever thought about buying a gun?
I'm Canadian, Phil. I'd never seen a gun brochure before. It looked illicit, like weird porn, freaky-deaky Danish porn where, quote-unquote, things are put into, quote-unquote, things. I didn't want to look at them. I said to him, Phil, you're not going to buy a fucking gun, are you?
It's a dangerous world out there, Mikey, he said.
Are you aware of the statistics of people being killed by their own guns? And besides, Phil, you're a Canadian. Phil said, I live in the valley, Mikey. Have you seen the statistics of the police response times? I left his office with an uneasy feeling.
On a happier note, one of the greatest moments of my time on Saturday Night Live was when Wayne Gretzky was the host. I immediately called my friends in Toronto. I thought I was being punked, and as luck would have it, Wayne was going to be on, quote-unquote, Wayne. I wrote a fantasy scene into the sketch just so I could play hockey with Wayne Gretzky. Gretzky is not only the great one, but he was one of Saturday Night Live's best hosts. He was a true gentleman. And at the end of the week, he gave me a game-used Wayne Gretzky hockey stick, a Titan TPM 2020 with his patented gripper butt end. It even had the talcum powder left on the tape-wrapped blade. Inscribed on it was, to Mike, thanks for all the fun at SNL. Your friend, I thank you, Wayne Gretzky. It is still one of my most prized possessions. It's my Excalibur. 4 months later, on the day of the last show of the season, my first season, I came to 30 Rock and was approached by a journalist. Mr. Myers, what are your thoughts about Gilda Radner? He asked. I thought, that's weird. How did they know that Gilda Radner had played my mom in a TV commercial in Canada? I said, what do you mean? The reporter said, Gilda Radner died this morning. I felt like somebody had punched me in the gut. It seemed so strange that, just as I was hitting a bit of a stride on the show, the lady I had fallen in love with as a little kid, whom I admired on the show, and the original cast member I ultimately felt I was most similar to, had died that day. I went to my office and cried. I didn't care if somebody called me Sucky Baby. After that show, which was the season finale, the mood was somber. The after party was subdued. But because tradition dictates that it take place outdoors in Rockefeller Plaza, where the hockey rink is during the winter months, I could see leaves budding on the trees that surround the piazza. It felt like a rebirth. The senior writer, who had implored me not to hand in Wayne's World, glanced my way sheepishly from across the way. He came over. Mike?
What?
Can I ask you a favor?
What?
My little brother wants to meet you. He's such a big fan. There was something about it being spring and about Gilda's passing that day that allowed me to